This is Enercast.
Hey, peace lovers. Welcome to another edition of Enercast, your home for anarchy on the internet. I have a special guest coming in today, a person that I've followed his work quite a bit and really like his work. He's an actual investigative journalist, which doesn't exist anymore on the mainstream media. So thank goodness for the internet that we actually have these people. It's James Corbett. He runs the Corbett Report. He's been doing that for a number of years. He has over 12 million YouTube views. He also has one of my favorite short videos called 9/11, A Conspiracy Theory, which succinctly explains the conspiracy theory as proposed by the government on 9/11. And we'll put a link to that below for sure. So how are you, James?
Well, I'm doing really good. I just hope I can live up to a glowing introduction like that, but I'll do my best.
Well, I could say much more. Obviously, there's so many things you've been doing great and great work. But before we begin, I always like to ask everyone, how did you become an anarchist?
Well, I think that my journey was a frustratingly slow one in retrospect, but I think a lot of people go through a similar process. Basically, I've been researching for the last 7 or 8 years now and had my website for the last 6 years, looking into the deep state connections that behind the national security state apparatus that arose in the wake of the National Security Act of 1947. And the creation and institutionalization of the CIA, and then we saw how the CIA immediately started using its powers to start to overthrow democratically elected leaders in foreign countries, in Iran, in Chile, in South America generally. And I've been looking and researching at that and how that developed into the networks that formed around Iran-Contra in the 1980s and how that extended in the 1990s with CIA drug smuggling, how it continues through today through events like 9/11 and the commandeering of American foreign policy towards endless intervention in the Middle East and unpopular wars of aggression that continue to occur. And I've been researching and documenting this for a number of years now, and it has, I think I started out in the way that a lot of people do when they're encountering this information, looking for that mythical return to some sort of constitutional government, and we don't need to really scrap government, that would be radical. What we need to do is just reform it, bring it back to by and of the people like it used to be, supposedly. And it took, as I say, a frustratingly long time for me to start to shake off of those status delusions that government has ever been anything about the coalescing of that power in the hands of a small ruling clique and the institutionalization of the monopoly and the use of force that comes along with that. So so that's exactly, unfortunately, the situation that we're in. And it took a very long time for me to realize that the solution is not to try to reduce government or bring it back to its rightful size or something of that sort. It took me a while to really start to align my philosophy with my own ideals and my own understanding of the situation, so that I finally eventually realized that, in fact, it was the statist delusion that is at the core of so much of this corruption that would not be able to exist if we didn't have these centralized institutions. And that's really where I've arrived at in the last couple of years. So now I'm more actively exploring the idea of anarchy and how that can be used as a solution to so many of these problems that we're facing.
That's fantastic. And it must have been very interesting for you to have this background and then to see 9/11 happening. I was still quite asleep at the time. I was busy with my own things. And I knew I didn't really like government at the time, but I didn't know why. And so when 9/11 happened, I really didn't think too much of it, except for what a horrible day that was. But it was just a few years after that I started to do some research and my eyes really started to open up. And now I'm one of the biggest proponents of people looking into 9/11. There's just so much evidence. We could go on and on about that. But how was that for you with your background on that day? Were you immediately quite suspicious?
Unfortunately, no. Quite like yourself, I was still quite sound asleep when it came to a lot of these issues at that time. I was fresh out of university, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and didn't quite understand what was happening in any sort of deeper sense. So I bought the official narrative hook, line, and sinker, and did for several years. In fact, I was quite resistant to the idea of conspiracy theories surrounding 9/11, so I was quite a vocal opponent of those for a number of years, until I started actually looking into the facts and details for myself and started to independently confirm a lot of these strange ideas I was hearing about Osama bin Laden and other connections. And when I started to really peel back those layers, it started to become apparent that this entire system was corrupt from top to bottom in a way that was really unfathomable to me before that point. And then it was really the work of people like Bill Still and others exposing the financial frauds and the central banking fraud that really opened my eyes to the way that the system really functions. And once I understood that financial lever of control, I think all of the other pieces slot into place behind it, because without obviously that centralized coercive tool of fiat money and the money that's created out of nothing by the centrally privately owned central bank of the United States and the privately owned central banks of many other countries, once you realize that level of control over the economy and over our lives, I think you start to realize just the extent to which our lives have been completely monopolized, and how this has been done under the cover, of course, of government and people wearing funny badges and nice looking hats and uniforms and what have you, claiming to act in your interests, when of course they're just another gang of thugs that are looking for their own cut and looking for people to fall in line behind them.
Yeah, the governments are there's only one difference between the government and the mafia, and that's size. And I've gone down different paths than you to get to this decision or to come to this understanding. It must be interesting also for you to be able to see what's going on in Syria right now. My personal take on it is that it's getting harder and harder for them to pull off these things thanks to the internet. People get access to real information now, not just information on mainstream media, which is basically just reading off of government press releases direct into a camera, and they're having much harder times now just trying to get the ball rolling on these things. What's your perspective on Syria?
Well, I always try to check my cognitive biases and my tendency towards confirmation bias on this, because obviously I'm deeply involved in the alternative media and this type of information on a daily basis, and I interact with people who are already aware of a lot of these issues. So I do have a lot of those types of confirmation biases that are available to me. But even within this echo chamber, I can see that genuinely the mainstream narrative, the mainstream political discourse is shifting right now, and there are more and more people who are willing to question these types of events and to really look at them, to the point where now it seems to be even in the mainstream media, or at the very least in the comment section of the mainstream media websites, where you can find a lot of the speculation about the latest chemical weapons attack and whether it really came from the terrorists, the foreign-funded, foreign-trained, foreign-supplied, and foreign terrorists who are invading Syria right now, who had everything to gain by this latest chemical weapons attack, rather than Assad, as is being asserted by John Kerry and the Obama administration, who had absolutely nothing to gain by the attack, which I think a few years ago would have been not only derided as conspiracy theory, but completely ignored. And we see this increasingly being directly addressed, even as I say, in the dinosaur mainstream media. So I really do think there is a fundamental shift that's happening right now. And that is hopeful in a lot of different ways, because I could certainly, in fact, I was a little bit surprised that not only was David Cameron, UK Prime Minister, shot down in the UK Parliament over trying to take the UK to war in Syria, but in fact, Obama even backed off and went to Congress, which is probably going to rubber stamp intervention anyway, but still the fact that he actually acquiesced a little bit is a bit surprising and shows that there is a fundamental change in consciousness that's taking place. And I hope that we'll be able to push that even further and get people to question the fundamental basis of this entire system of government that they're unfortunately trapped in, and a lot of people are happily trapped in at this point.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to see what's going on. I don't think the U.S. government and the central banks can win on this one now. They've really made a misstep here. I think they underestimated what's going on in the world and the amount of awakening that's going on. And you can see that with Obama backing off now. So if they back off, a lot of people around the world are going to realize, wow, we can actually change. We can stop war just with our own minds and just by making comments and just going on Facebook and saying something about it. And if they do go and attack with such a low level of support, as a black last week was about 8%, as far as I heard, in the U.S. of people who thought they should attack Syria. If they go ahead and attack, and especially with all the world really rising up about it, that will also hurt them, because they'll be seen really as occupiers and the evil ones, the people that are really doing bad things. So either the way, they're going to lose on this one. And you brought up a great point, which I've brought up many times over the years, about the comments section on media sites. I rarely even read much of the article, because it's usually just pablum. and it usually just totes the state line. But then you go to the comments section, and there's maybe 1 in 100 that actually supports the article. It's mostly just people saying, that's bullshit. What are you talking about? Haven't you heard this? Haven't you read this? Haven't you seen the official documents on that? And really making it out. I think they're going to have to turn off the comments section on most of those mainstream media sites.
That's it. And they already are in some cases, and they're trying to put more of these sites behind subscriber paywalls and the like. But I think that really, I mean, the cat's out of the bag at this point. And the more that the mainstream dinosaur media tries to hide behind subscription paywalls and the like, the more the alternative media will gain in subscribers and readership as well. So I really think that there is a fundamental change that's taking place. And I think the cat is out of the bag on so many of these issues. And you raise an important point about people actually discovering that they do have power to affect the discourse, and they really can change the course of society, because it's a fascinating phenomenon that has been actually scientifically studied for decades now. It's called learned helplessness, and psychologists like Martin Seligman and others have been researching into this. And through various experiments they've conducted, they've found, for example, that when you place dogs in a situation where they're put in a room or a place where they are actually electric shock through the floor, the dogs will jump out of the area in order to get away from it. But if they erect a barrier so that the dogs can't actually get out of the way of the electric shock, eventually the dogs stop even trying to get out of the way of the shock. And even if they remove the barrier at that point, the dogs will simply lay down and take the shock because they've been trained that they can't do anything about it. And I think in a very similar manner, I think that the population has been trained for a very long time that it does not matter one lick whether you vote for the left party or the right party, whether you campaign, whether you march on the streets, whatever you do, the oligarchy is going to continue marching forward with whatever they want to do. And I think that's been a long process of conditioning that the public has been under, that they are helpless, that there's nothing that they can do, that they should just sit down and take the shock. But I think increasingly with things like this, this latest backdown on Syria, I think you're right. I think this might be a moment where people realize the barrier isn't there and they can jump out of the way of this shock at any time. And that is a very dangerous proposition for the establishment, which is why I think that the internet is probably the real battleground and the real domain where we'll see the real wars of the 21st century taking place, the war for the occupation of the mind of the public.
Yeah, and Janet Napolitano, who's outgoing on the Department of Homeland Insecurity, has already warned of a major cyber attack coming that will likely come from the U.S. government or factions of it, or the CIA as usual. It's going to be very interesting. And you mentioned about those dogs. That really accurately describes a lot of Americans today. Obviously not all, can't generalize. However, whenever I go to the U.S., they just seem so whipped. And you see all these police brutality videos now, and people just standing around almost begging them to stop, but not doing anything in the so-called land of the brave. It's really amazing to see that. And you also brought up how alternative media is changing things. That must be very exciting or very interesting to you. You've been doing this since, I believe, 2007. And to see the changes, it must be quite an exciting time for you.
It really is, and this is something that I can experience directly through my own website and the growth of it over the years. It's been quite an amazing process, really, because when I started my website, this was all still the type of things that was just completely derided as conspiracy theory and very, very much a marginal idea. And I see this increasingly becoming, as I say, part of the central political discourse right now. And we saw, for example, in the wake of the recent Boston Marathon bombing, just if you look at Google Trends, you notice the searches for things like false flag increased just exponentially after in the wake of that. And this really is becoming the type of information that people are more and more talking about. So I really do think that the alternative media is having a profound effect and is really shaping the discourse. And it's really a question of whether we'll be able to parlay that into people taking positive actions at the local level in ways that they can actually influence the world around them, rather than getting caught up in mere political games of brinksmanship and trying to outsmart this or that political party as a way of trying to move societal discourse.
Yeah, it is exciting times for sure. And it's going to be a lot of interesting things happening in the next few years. There's going to be all sorts of likely false flag events again. The Syrian Department of some department guy, some criminal in Syria said that the gas attacks recently were actually done by the U.S. and Europe or some faction of them, whoever runs those governments. And he also warned that Europe will probably be attacked next to bring them into war. But I think less and less this stuff's working over time. Even things like the Boston Marathon bombing, within hours, investigative journalists and kids from around the world had dissected every photo and every video and found all the holes in the story. So it's really an amazing time. I want to ask you about Japan because you've lived there near Fukushima. And I want to ask you about Fukushima. But before we get into that, why did you move to Japan? And what's your take on Japan in general? I've been watching the Bank of Japan. I write out a newsletter called the dollarvigilante.com where I look at all the financial and economic and I watch what's going on with the central banks. And they just said they're going to double the money supply in Japan in the next 2 years. I'd be very curious to hear all your thoughts on all of that.
Well, I moved out here about 9 years ago, and originally it was just a way of spending another year as I decided what to do with my life. So I was just going to come out here for a year and teach English, and that year ended up being 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Here I am 9 years later with a wife and a son here in Japan, so it looks like I may be here for the long haul. But now I do have a front row seat for this this economic collapse, the worldwide economic collapse that is inevitably coming with the way that they've extended the bubbles. And of course, we recently had a Bank of England senior official come out to say that they have intentionally blown the largest bond bubble in history through this all of this quantitative easing that's been going on in the wake of the 2008 meltdown. So here we are in Japan, and we see the government of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe that was elected back in December coming in and promising to, as you say, to expand, to double the money supply in the next 2 years, which is a pretty ambitious feat. And we saw the markets here start to react to that immediately, and we saw that, for example, the Nikkei index spike dramatically in the wake of that announcement. But interestingly enough, since then, it's basically leveled off, and it hasn't been able to break past the highs that it reached and the initial wave of enthusiasm over this. And we've seen that the momentary spike in GDP that this caused was largely ephemeral, too. It was largely based on market expectations of what this doubling of the money supply is going to do rather than anything that it's actually done. And we see, in fact, capital investment actually decreasing at this point. So it seems like a failed policy from the get-go, and unfortunately, it's just part of that currency war, which we see shaping up from central banks around the world as they all turn to this quantitative easing magic fairy dust from heaven that apparently is going to solve all financial problems simply by creating more money. And in Japan, it's especially problematic because whatever they gain from devaluing the yen in order to increase exports, they lose in terms of energy importation. And of course, Japan being very much a country that depends on energy imports, that's basically shooting themselves in the foot, even as they try to give themselves an injection of morphine. So it's I think it is a policy that's doomed to failure, and it's just a question of how long before the markets here in Japan really understand that. And it's a question of what can be done about it also, because we, of course, have an incredible situation of the largest debt-to-GDP ratio in the developed world here in Japan, now running well over 200%. And we have the Japanese bonds is the second largest bond market in the world behind the United States, and is exceptionally overextended right now. And you have the demographic tidal wave that's coming here in Japan, as with an aging society that's increasingly retiring and stopping buying the bonds, which has been funding the Japanese government for decades now, and starting to cash some of those bonds. So we're seeing, I think, the unwinding of a generational bubble that's been going on here that is getting set to unwind in a very spectacular way. So it wouldn't surprise me if Japan really ended up being the trigger point for the global economic collapse.
Yeah, I've been saying the exact same thing. I've been looking at it quite a bit. Japan's such an interesting place. It was a little over 100 years ago, they were basically samurais. And they very quickly became a world power by the time the 1940s came around. And of course, what happened with Pearl Harbor and World War II is that the U.S. government shut off their oil supplies and they just had a few days of oil left. And they were left in a very dangerous, dire situation. And they decided to militarily attack the U.S. for that. And everyone knows the rest of that story. But then they were basically really destroyed again. Hiroshima, where you live close to, and Nagasaki were just completely destroyed in some of the biggest terrorist attacks ever done on Earth. And then they built up again. They went all capitalist again. And by the end of the 80s, or early 80s, or middle 80s, they were the most powerful country on Earth. The Imperial Palace was worth more than the entire state of California real estate. And then they collapsed again. And really interesting. I'd like to hear your take on it about so many people talk about how there's been deflation in Japan. But if you actually watch the money supply of the yen, it hasn't really been deflation. It's just been very low inflation. And now you bring up a lot of great points about all the issues they have to deal with. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. But what's your take on that whole deflation period that everyone talks about? Was it as bad as they said? Because I've been to Japan many times and everything seemed to be fairly decent.
Well, first of all, let me just comment on what you said there, because you talk about the incredible change that Japanese society has undergone in the past century, and in some respects, you're exactly right about that. I mean, an incredible change has taken place at least since the 19th century, when Japan was opened up by the U.S. at the barrel of a gun, and really had to end its isolation, which it had been undergoing for over a millennia. So it is a fascinating society in a lot of ways. But the interesting part to me is that, although on the surface the country has changed completely, and we see this reflected in a lot of different ways, and of course the kind of Americanization of Japan in the wake of World War II is one of those aspects that's often pointed to, but the underlying structure of Japanese society, I think, is almost identical. Basically, you had the sort of feudal society that existed with the shoguns and the samurai and all of that in the past has just been transplanted into the modern context, so that you still have the very few families that own the big Mitsubishis and Toyotas and Sonys and the big corporations are still running things. They're just running things from that kind of capitalist perspective. So it's still very much an oligarchy that runs this still very feudal society, and you still get that stratification and basically a population that's very subservient to the greater good as it's drilled into them from a very young age. But regarding the deflationary period and the stagnation of the Japanese economy, I mean, what we've seen here is basically a couple of decades where we've seen the unwinding of that incredible bubble that was blown up in the 1980s. And of course, the real estate bubble was really, the nail in the coffin, because once that started to unwind, there was just basically no way out from under that. And basically, they've been able to maintain a certain level of the economy underneath that. But it's a question of trying to grow the economy out from underneath that popped bubble. And that's been an exceptionally difficult process, especially because the Japanese government has been keeping a lot of the banking sector here, basically zombie banks, keeping them afloat through injections and safeguarding and regulations and things of that sort. And now a lot of the banks here are exceptionally invested in Japanese government bonds as well. So the bond market volatility that we're seeing with this latest attempt to inflate the money supply is, again, exceptionally worrying, because, again, it exposes a lot of these banks that could go under and start to undermine the economy in very fundamental ways. So I think a lot of this has been sort of a maintenance that's been going on, that's been propped up through Japanese government spending. But eventually there comes a time when the piper has to be paid. And I think they're seeing that now. So they're trying to grow the economy through this, as I say, magic pixie dust from heaven through the central bank. But I don't think it's going to be effective. And it's really just a matter of time until the general perception of the market catches up with what people who are actually watching the numbers coming out of the market already know, which is that this is a failed policy.
I agree. And it sounds very similar to the U.S. About propping up zombie banks and regulations and all that sort of a thing. But I think things are speeding up in the U.S. very quickly now. And the amount of debt in the U.S. is just tremendous. It's basically, when you look at it under generally accepted accounting principles, it's over $80 trillion, which is $250,000 per person in the U.S. or $1 million per family of four, federal government debt and liabilities. It's also interesting that you pointed out Japanese society. I've been over there many times. It is just an incredibly interesting place. I've done business over there, and it is totally different than anywhere else in the world. When you go to meet a CEO of a major corporation, which I have done during the tech bubble, you have to enter in through different doors. There's a certain sort of, it's really interesting. Everyone has to walk in the certain ranks. So the CEO comes first with the other CEO, and then the other people and the different ranks sit closest to him. It's very interesting. But you pointed out they have so much debt. and their deficit in trade, which is the first time they've had a deficit in trade in decades, mostly due to the energy situation, which is mostly due to Fukushima, is it's really a lot of issues, and I don't know what's going to happen there. But let me ask you about Fukushima. I hear so much about it. You live close to it. Tell me your thoughts on Fukushima, on the nuclear disaster in Fukushima.
Well, let's take a look at the big picture here, the real history of the nuclear industry in Japan, because in some ways it's absolutely mind-boggling that a country that was the only country ever to be attacked with nuclear weapons ended up embracing nuclear energy and embraced it so quickly and so completely to the point where there are, I believe, 52 reactors in the country right now. 50 of which are offline in the wake of Fukushima, and in fact, all of them were offline for a brief period last year, but they will be starting to be switched back on eventually here. So it is, it's fascinating to look at that history, and in fact, the role of the CIA and CIA operatives in the Japanese media here who helped to spread and propagate the idea of how wonderful the nuclear energy would be for this country. And of course, this has been facilitated by kickbacks from the corporations that that run these power plants to the local governments that then approve the construction of these power plants. And some of that corruption has been highlighted in the wake of Fukushima. But this is the background to it. And of course, we have to also understand that the nuclear energy industry itself is, again, a government creation that could not exist without government support and funding and backing. Because it is not a financially viable industry, the way it's been set up, and the types of reactors that exist right now, the uranium reactors, only exist for one purpose at the end of the day, and that is ultimately as a supplement to the nuclear weapons industry. And again, the nuclear energy industry doesn't make any financial sense from any other perspective, and that's, I think, something we have to keep in mind. We also have to keep in mind that, of course, that's part of the reason why Japan has these nuclear reactors, is so that they can, at the flip of a switch, basically flip over from nuclear energy to nuclear weapons production if and when they ever need to do so. So the idea that Japan is a nuclear-free country is only technically true, I think, in the nuclear weapons sense. But with regards to Fukushima specifically, I mean, this is another example of not government incompetence, but actual government complicity in attempting to cover up every aspect of this. I mean, we had the former prime minister here, who was the prime minister during the crisis, Naoto Kan, come out after he left office and was basically saying, yes, I was being advised that we might have had to evacuate Tokyo, which is, again, just a mind-boggling possibility. But he immediately ruled that out because that would basically be the end of Japanese society as we know it. So he basically just immediately vetoed that. And we know that in every single way that they could, they attempted to cover up as much information as they could from the public about what was happening at Fukushima. Not only the fact that they knew within hours that there were three of the reactors were in meltdown, which was confirmed within hours, but again, it took them a month and a half to actually come out and admit that. But also, there was data that was collected by a radiation monitoring system here in Japan called SPEEDY that is actually set up exactly for these types of scenarios, these types of nuclear crises, as a way of supposedly providing accurate information about forecasts of where radiation fallout will be occurring, etc., so that the public can actually be informed about these things. And that data was specifically and admittedly, it's now been confirmed, was being withheld from the public for weeks after the event, because it did show problematic things like, oh, some of the fallout was going directly over Tokyo. So again, they've been trying to cover up information about this from the get-go, and unfortunately, things are not getting substantially better. In December of 2011, they declared a cold shutdown, i.e. that the water within the reactor buildings was below 100 degrees, so it wasn't at risk of boiling off and causing core melt-through anymore, or so they wanted people to believe. And after that point, basically, the media turned away from this story. But unfortunately, what we now know is that not only do we not know actually where the cores actually are sitting and whether they have actually melted through the reactor containment, But also we, even regardless of that potential and the potential that the water is leaking directly out of the containment units in, and directly into the groundwater, we now know that, that regardless of that, the radioactive water that they've been cycling through there to cool off the reactors and that is accumulating at however many tons per day it is, I'm not sure off the top of my head, but a significant amount of water that they are having to store on site, basically just store there indefinitely until it can be decontaminated to acceptable levels. There is increasingly leaks happening in those containments now, so that just last month, I believe 300 tons of water was confirmed to have leaked directly out into the Pacific that contained unprecedented levels of radiation. The normal levels of radioactive water that they're working with is something in the neighborhood of 150 becquerels per liter. This water was 80 million becquerels per liter. And we saw tritium readings in Fukushima Harbor area spike to all-time record highs. And we've seen some of the hot spots around these water containment facilities is now spiked to 2,200 millisieverts per hour, which is enough to kill a human being that's exposed to it for more than a few hours. Just incredible escalation, I guess, in the scale of what's going on there, to the point where even the Japanese government now has to admit that this is a serious problem. And we have the chairman of the Japanese Nuclear Regulatory Authority that was set up in the wake of Fukushima, the chairman Shinichi Tanaka just came out and admitted that TEPCO has no ability to handle this crisis, that the Japanese government is going to have to come in and handle it for them, that they're now ready to commit $500 million to the containment efforts. They're going to try to build an ice wall around the facility in order to stop any contaminated groundwater from getting out into the rest of the country, and they're basically hoping and praying that they'll be able to contain this somehow. But TEPCO has already called for international assistance in trying to deal with this problem. And the worst part about this is the technology doesn't even exist yet at this point to actually do anything fundamentally about this. I mean, they can't even get in to see where the cores are sitting right now, let alone do anything to really contain the incredible amounts of water that they're having to cycle through there on a daily basis. So it is a crisis situation still, regardless of whether or not the Dinosaur Media is interested in reporting on that.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. I'm not a physical nuclear physicist, or I don't understand a lot of that stuff. But I just pay attention and I watch things and I read things. And to me, the whole nuclear thing seems a little bit overblown. I know people in the U.S. West Coast who are moving out of there because they say the ocean water is so irradiated that it's going to be very dangerous. A lot of them are moving down to a place. I'm starting in Chile, but I just looked at some maps and according to the maps, Chile would also get some of that. I also saw a video in the 80s or 70s of this nuclear physicist guy who rolled around in plutonium, like radioactive plutonium. He was eating it, and he was trying to tell people it wasn't that bad. And when I look back at Chernobyl, for example, and there's another case, as you pointed out, that it was mostly about nuclear arms, not about nuclear energy. That was basically a nuclear arms facility that really just had a major problem. And definitely within a circumference of that place, there definitely was problems. But how worldwide can this get? And also for you, living a few hundred kilometers away, if I understand it correctly, what do you feel about your own personal safety?
Well, I think you're right. There is, unfortunately, a tendency to overblow and to sensationalize some of this information, which creates fear in people that is not altogether warranted, to the point where I have people constantly asking me, well, Japan is a nuclear wasteland. Why do you live there? Well, obviously, I don't think that it is a nuclear wasteland at this point, and certainly 700 kilometers southwest of the plant, I'm not particularly concerned about the atmospheric effects. At this point, this isn't a concern in terms of it leaking radiation out into the atmosphere, like was the concern, for example, at Chernobyl or in the early days of the Fukushima crisis. At this point, it is the radioactive water and the possibility of contamination of the groundwater and then into the ocean, which is the main concern. And although the radiation from the Fukushima disaster has been and is being detected in fish, for example, fished off the west coast of North America, at this point, it isn't the type of radioactive crisis on the west coast of North America that would warrant, I think, people moving away from the coast. But certainly in Japan, one of the major concerns is the contamination of the fish in the Pacific region. And interestingly enough, just last year, they lifted the ban off of fishing on Fukushima, fished in the region of Fukushima. So that was being sold in the Tokyo fish markets, again, quite openly. And then now, in the wake of this recent revelation about the 300 tons of water that leaked out last month, the ongoing leaks that are occurring on the site, they have once again reinstituted the ban on fishing in Fukushima. So again, this shows the severity of what we're dealing with here. And that's why, when it comes to my own family's safety, the number one concern really is the seafood itself, where the fish are being directly exposed to this, the radioactive water that's leaking off of the site. So we're very much careful about avoiding seafood to the extent possible, and if not, at least sourcing exactly where it's coming from and making sure it's not from the Pacific side of Japan. But as having said that, again, I think that some people do overreact to this information, and people who are living on the west coast of North America who are trying to flee to Chile, which, as you point out, it would be in the path of this radioactive water anyway. I think that's a bit overblown at this point. So I try to straddle the information that's coming out between the sensationalized and overblown information, and then the other side, which is coming from the government and from TEPCO, which is trying to downplay this information as much as possible. So I have a site, FukushimaUpdate.com, where I try to keep a balanced eye on what's actually going on there. So I hope people can use that as kind of a resource to find out as much information as they can about what's happening there on a daily basis.
Well, that's very interesting. I didn't know about that. I'll definitely check it out. You sound like a very, well, I know you are by all your other reports, that you're very rational and you look at all the evidence and you don't try to sensationalize things, which is what the mainstream media generally tries to do. But they generally sensationalize things that are unimportant, and they totally don't report on things that are actually important. For a guy like me who's sitting here smoking a cigarette, and then I talk to a lot of Americans, they're living in a place where they're drinking fluoride every day. Their chemtrails are coming over them every day. I don't know what you think about that, or I don't know if you want to comment on that. It's not too important to me, but they're just constantly under attack. Their central banks are going to destroy the economy. The government is turning into a police state. I tend to think more about things like that, because those things are much more in my face than something like radiation from Fukushima. So it's very interesting to hear your views on that. And I don't know if you want to talk about anything I just spoke on, but I'll give you an opportunity if you'd like to.
Absolutely. Well, I've done work on chemtrails as well. I've got a podcast called Geoengineering and You, where I talk to people like Rosalind Peterson and others about that. And I think you're right. I mean, I've covered fluoride to a large degree, talking to people like Dr. Paul Connett of the Fluoride Action Network. I think you're right. There are so many different health issues that are out there that concentrating specifically on radiation in North America. In fact, if people are concerned about radiation in North America, and maybe they should be after all, but not necessarily from Fukushima, but from all of the nuclear plants and testing that's gone on in the United States itself. And that's kind of an interesting part about this, because people's perception is that Japan and Fukushima is the nuclear threat to the world, which it could potentially be if the containment of Reactor 4 actually collapses, where the spent fuel pool is that currently houses, I believe, 1,900 spent fuel rods, which contain enough radiation to contaminate the northern hemisphere many times over. So that is a potential of this situation that we have to keep our eye on. But barring that eventuality, the interesting thing is that in North America, the biggest threats are from natural background radiation and from radiation nuclear testing and the like that's gone on in North America before. And you can see this at a site called safecast.org, where they have a map that's been built from individuals who have their own Geiger counters, their own readings that feed into this network, and it compiles all of this information and creates a map of the world that shows the various radioactive hotspots. And if you look at Japan, the Japanese map, you will find that in many areas of Japan, except for right around the Fukushima plant, most of the areas show very low levels of reading compared to some areas of the United States, like in Arizona, where obviously the radiation readings are much higher because of what's gone on there historically. So people's perceptions on this issue, I think, are greatly skewed. And I think you're right. There are a lot of health issues that people should be concentrating on. on, rather than perhaps radiation from halfway around the world.
Yeah, and often a lot of the Americans will bring up Fukushima, will be sitting there and they eat at McDonald's every day, and they're eating all kinds of garbage, which is full of toxins, and drinking a giant Coca-Cola with high fructose corn syrup, and you know, all sorts of other things. That's my perspective on things, is that, you know, there is a lot of things to worry about health, but I haven't been over here. I live in Mexico on the West Coast, but I haven't given it a great amount of worry, because I see much more problems in the world that are much more dire at this moment in time, including, I think, what will be the collapse of the entire Western monetary system. And I think Japan may be the first to go, and it's going to be incredibly interesting, and people should be paying attention to that a lot more. You brought up a lot of the sites that you write for. I had no idea, or I have podcasts. You must keep incredibly busy, and it's great. I think you put out great information. So for anyone watching this, definitely check out James Corbett and all of his stuff, and we'll try to put as many links to all of his podcasts and articles, and he's also on boilingfrogspost.com. He's all over the place. I don't know how he does it. But if you'd like to, James, why don't you tell people any final comments you'd like to make, and where else they can get more information from you?
Well, let me just invite people to check out my main website, CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. And that's basically where you'll find links to all of my work. And I think the flagship of that website is my podcast, which is about a one-hour report that goes out once a week. But I do interviews and articles and videos. I do reports for BoilingFrogsPost.com, for GlobalResearch.ca. I write an editorial for the International Forecaster newsletter. So, yes, I am spread remarkably thin, and so there's a lot of work out there. But basically, I hope people will use that work that I've created as a resource for them to, as sort of a springboard for their own research. I never ask people to take what I say at face value. I always ask them to look at primary sources and follow links back to the documentation. And I always try to provide those links so people can do their own research. But I think that the anarchy side of what I'm doing is increasingly important, because it seems to me that the answer to so many of the problems that we're dealing with will not come from the political arena. It will come from people starting to realize their own responsibility for protecting themselves and those around them. And through that, I think we'll find a spontaneous order arising that will supplant all of these governmental agencies that are causing so much of the havoc that we're seeing and experiencing in the world on a daily basis.
Well, I couldn't think of a better way to end this than that. So there you have it, another great anarchist trying to spread truth and information and actually doing his research. And you heard it straight from him. He's not always right. Back in 9/11, he was wrong initially, but he did his research. That's all we're trying to do. We're truth seekers. And I think I agree completely with James that the only answer to a really prosperous future for us as humanity is to get out of this mindset of letting the government or allowing the government to lead a lot of these things. We have to take our own responsibility, and you have all the resources you need with people like James Corbett, myself, read the dollarvigilante.com, stick with us here at anarchast.com, and so many others. We could go on and on about so many great people, and thankfully we have the internet today, and I think this is really our chance as humanity to awaken and to create a much better, much more prosperous future. So that's it for Anarchast, your home for anarchy on the internet. Peace, love, and anarchy.